You are listening to a sermon by Veronica Dick, recorded on Sunday, October 5th, 2014, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
It's actually quite fun to be in the Okanagan at this time of year when the harvest is going on. And their farmers markets already have wineries. Like, I think that's coming to Vancouver, but they're like 8:30 in the morning, there's 10 wineries you can go taste at the farmers market. And I'm hoping that none of the wine I bought last week is made from sour grapes. The other thing to know about the text for my talk today is that Isaiah 5:1-7 is actually one of the alternate readings. If you look at the readings, there's sometimes other traditions like the Roman Catholic or the Lutheran, they sometimes have a reading that is not the designated one. We're actually supposed to be hearing about the Ten Commandments today, but I'm not going to do that. So typically when I'm looking for a Sunday where I'm willing to speak after looking at my calendar, making sure there's no conflicts, I tend to look for a text where there's a narrative, like parables are great, or some kind of story, because I just find they're easier to talk about than other genres like, you know, thou shalt nots and all that kind of stuff. So I said, okay, October 5, calendar, check. The parable of the wicked tenants who kill the owner's son in Matthew. Perfect. So I started browsing my sources, and I started getting a niggling feeling that I had seen some of these before. And I checked, and sure enough, August 2008, I spoke on this exact same text. And you guys all remember that one, right? Yeah. But now it's too late. The speaker committee, I actually bumped somebody to keep this Sunday, and then I found that I'd spoken on the text before. Anyway, I was oddly comforted by the fact that the reason I had spoken about this parable actually wasn't because I had gone to the lectionary, but it was during the summer that we were doing a series on parables, and that one was assigned to me. So I don't know, for some reason I feel better about my brain fart. But the Isaiah reading from the lectionary for today is clearly behind the parable in Matthew that Jesus speaks to the religious leaders. And there are definitely some strong parallel themes and lessons which we will hear. But the text is also a word to the Hebrew people of the 8th century before the Common Era, who lived in the southern kingdom of Judah in the time of the prophet Isaiah. And it's worth looking at the text in and of itself to see what it might have said to them and then what it says to us today. And the Psalm passage is actually also an alternate reading for today. It's usually in rotation during Advent, and I think in years B and C. But as we've heard, the vineyard metaphor is very strong here, and so we'll touch on that a bit later as well. You've likely already heard, if you've been hearing sermons for some years, and Isaiah, which always gets quoted during Messiah and stuff, that Isaiah is roughly divided into three sections. Scholarly debate over when each section was written and whether the same or different authors wrote what we know as the final text. Those are abundant. Our text today, however, is pretty clearly in the early period, generally including chapters 1 to 39, attributed to the Isaiah of Jerusalem, when Ahaz was the king of Judah and the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser had initiated a campaign against the northern kingdom of Israel, ultimately deporting the 10 tribes into exile. Ahaz, the king of Judah, had been under pressure to join the coalition of northern Syria and the kingdom of Israel against this king, but Isaiah had counseled the king to trust in the Lord instead, which ended up delaying the exile of Judah for another over 100 years. We can be fairly confident about the text being close to the oldest versions. As the scroll found at Qumran in 1948, the text is almost identical to the sources that had been known to that time. The book of Isaiah opens with a series of oracles, mainly about Judah and Jerusalem. In chapters 2 to 4, there are prophecies of salvation and judgment, specifically against the wealthy landowners and religious leaders. Our text, which we look at in a short while, continues this theme in a clever parable-like song spoken by the prophet on behalf of Yahweh, with the verses following our reading giving more specific woe or oracles. And then the call of the prophet follows in chapter 6, and then after more messages to Judah and Jerusalem ends in a psalm of deliverance in chapter 12. In addition to the political background of the surrounding nations, the historical period up to and including Isaiah's period is also marked by economic and social changes, which are important for understanding the verses we're studying today. It wouldn't take long for a survey of ancient Near Eastern texts to determine that the cultivation of grain, olive trees, and grapevines was profoundly important for food security and the economic well-being of individuals and of countries. After olives, the grape was the single most important crop, providing fresh fruit, raisins, raisin honey, grape juice, and of course wine. The cultivation of grapes and making of wine is widely depicted in text and images throughout Egypt and Mesopotamia. It helped shape ancient economies and served as a metaphor for wealth, prosperity, and covenant relationships. Grapes had been domesticated from the smaller wild variety for some time by Isaiah's day. Grafting proven vines ensured a consistent crop. In Palestine, vineyards would have been planted near the farmer's house, perhaps mixed in with the orchard and even trained to grow up the trees. The climate, soil, and landscape was particularly favorable in this area, unlike actually Egypt or other parts where it wasn't that favorable. And nearly every village in the hill country would have had vineyards and wine presses. In the 8th century before the Common Era, Israel and Judah saw an increase in international trade, where leaders began importing luxury goods and military implements. And to pay for these imports, grain, oil, and wine were exported. The imports benefited the minority urban elite, but the goods used to pay for them cut deeply into the crop sustaining the peasant majority. Lands were consolidated, pressure to grow cash crops to the exclusion of a variety of food increased, absentee landlords multiplied, and the family lands were foreclosed and peasant workers found themselves laboring for poor wages on land which had previously belonged to them. Mm. Sounds awfully familiar, doesn't it? Mm. The setting of a vineyard in today's text is not neutral. So I'd like to spend a few minutes looking at the actual Isaiah text, verses 1 and 2. Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. The verse begins in the first person and describes itself as a song. A large portion of the articles I read in preparation for today are concerned with trying to identify what kind of text, what genre of text this passage falls under, which, you know, fair enough, the genre determines how you interpret it. Is this an actual song, perhaps modeled on one that would have been traditionally sung during the harvest festival of booths? Or is it a marriage song, metaphorical references to the vineyard as the bride? And who's actually the speaker here? But we'll spend a bit more time on that later. The Hebrew word for beloved here does not, in fact, need to carry any romantic or sexual connotation. But it does want to establish a close and intimate relationship between the speaker and the owner of the vineyard. So you might say dear friend might be a better or a different translation, might carry the right tone. The offer of singing a love song, shifting unexpectedly to focus on the beloved's vineyard, would have immediately grabbed the audience's attention. The vineyard described had everything possible done to ensure a good harvest. The choice setting on a hillside, probably in a series of terraces. The soil had been cleared of stones, and only when the soil was ready were choice vines planted. The word used for vines here, sorek, literally mean red, and point to the rich red wine which these grapes traditionally produced, as opposed to the more common gefem vines. During the Festival of Booths, temporary structures are built during the harvest, but here a permanent watchtower is to protect the grapes from human and animal predators is built. So it's showing a really high value placed on this vineyard. The wine vat would also have been a major construction project. It was a pit carved out of stone where the grapes would be crushed, and it would have channels leading to other storage pits where from there it would be drained into urns or wineskins. The audience in Isaiah's day would have known this process well, and they would have appreciated that this labor and preparation would not be the work of just one season. Typically, it takes 5 or 6 years before a vineyard is ready to produce choice wine. And yet, instead of sweet grapes, the harvest is wild grapes. The Hebrew derived from a verb meaning to stink. Now, I used, in my title, I said sour grapes because some of my sources did, and it makes you think of Aesop's fable, the fox and the sour grapes, so that's fine. But in fact, the translation is more like rotten, stinky grapes. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard than I have not done in it? When I expected it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Those wise. The text begins to hint at the tension yet to come, as the speaker changes from the friend to the owner of the vineyard, from the past to the present, asking the listeners to offer judgment. Surely there was no fault in the attention lavished on the grapes. So why was the harvest bad? The audience would have agreed. Everything possible was done. The fault must lie in the vineyard and the wild grapes themselves. The harvest is worthless, has no nutritional value, and is unfit for the intended purpose of making wine. After the back-breaking investment of labor and of time, the land is too precious to allow the present crop to remain. Verse 5, and now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed. It shall be overgrown with briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. There's not much need for explanation of what is described here. The anger of the owner and the urge to tear down the vineyard is completely understandable from a human emotional perspective. However, it is here that we finally learn who the speaker is. That is, Yahweh himself is the owner of the vineyard. No one else would have the power to order the clouds to stop raining. God has demonstrated endless patience in his cultivation of the vineyard and waiting for the harvest. But look at the method Yahweh chooses to mete out his punishment. God does not attack the vines with pruning hooks. God does not set fire to the uprooted plants. No, it's even more terrifying. More terrifying than exacting violence from the vineyard. Yahweh simply withdraws his care. The fence is removed, and while animals are allowed to forage the grapes and trample the vines, no more pruning and trimming of the plants, so weeds and thorns will establish themselves and choke out the grapevines. And the final act, which ensures that the vineyard will no longer flourish, is the withholding of life-giving water. The vineyard will return to chaos, the land will become waste. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are his pleasant planting. He expected justice, but saw bloodshed, righteousness, but heard a cry. After following along the song with empathy for the owner's plight and understandable anger at the wasted harvest, the listener is trapped. No more guessing. The last verse makes clear that they, the people themselves, are the disappointing harvest, and that no blame can be attached to the owner, who has never ceased to show them patience and care. The Hebrew text makes a wordplay in the final phrase. God expected justice, mispat, but saw bloodshed, mispak. Righteousness, tzedekka, but heard a cry, tzedakka. The Lord looked for good fruit and found foul. Yahweh looked for right living and right relationships and instead found anguish and despair as found among those who are oppressed. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of academic energy spent on determining the classification of literature for a text today. Is it a song? Well, partly. I mean, the text does use that word at the beginning. A love poem, which turns into a complaint against the bride. And there are certainly examples in Scripture using the bridegroom metaphor in the relation of Israel and Yahweh. However, that leads to some pretty convoluted speculation on who the speaker is in relation to the bride and how the punishments relate to matrimonial crimes. So probably not. Is it a judgment curse? True. There are certainly parallels in other parts of the Deuteronomic history books and other prophets. And what about a parable or an allegory? Well, an allegory uses symbolic characters or actions to illustrate a truth, but that's actually not a genre used very often in Scripture, and I don't think it applies here. The Song of the Vineyard is actually closer to something we can call a juridical parable, or put another way, a self-condemning parable. And the most well-known example of this in the Hebrew Scripture is from 2 Samuel 12, where the prophet Nathan confronts King David with the parable of the rich man who stole the only lamb of a poor man. Nathan rouses David's anger at the injustice against the rich man, only to have the story twist and condemn himself for the sin he committed with Bathsheba and ordering her husband Uriah to be put in harm's way at the battlefront. So who has allowed there to be bloodshed instead of justice? Why are there cries of those oppressed instead of righteous behavior, which cares for the widow and helps the poor? Is it the whole of Israel and Judah? There's a strong argument to be made that the indictment in our text is directed at the ruling elite who are benefiting from the boom in viticulture and the expropriation of peasant farmers by unjust means. We only have to read a few chapters earlier in Isaiah, chapter 3, and I'm just going to read three verses using the New English Bible translation. It says it a little clearer. Isaiah 3, 12 to 15. Oppressors treat my people cruelly. Creditors rule over them. My people's leaders mislead them. They give you confusing directions. The Lord takes his position to judge. He stands up to pass sentence on his people. The Lord comes to pronounce judgment on the leaders of his people and their officials. He says, "It is you who have ruined the vineyard. You have stashed in your houses what you have stolen from the poor. Why do you crush my people and grind the faces of the poor?" The sovereign Lord who commands armies has spoken. Moreover, the verses right after the selection from the lectionary in Isaiah 5 go on to list examples of the actions of those who have produced such a bitter harvest. Taking only verses 8 to 10, for the next three after the text. You who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is room for no one but you, and you are left to live alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield a mere ephah. The bath and ephah, those are apparently units of peasant labor. Isaiah is denouncing the ruling classes who have amassed enormous wealth by their actions against the peasant and small land-owning classes. In time, Judah as well as Israel will be carried away from the land because of the sin of those who did not care for the poor and the dispossessed. Now, turning just briefly to the Matthew New Testament reading, Matthew 21 occurs in the story of in the gospel story of after Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem. Jesus then drives out the moneylenders from the temple. He cures the blind and the lame. And when he's challenged by the leaders, "By what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority?" Jesus asks them a question instead regarding the source of John the Baptist's ministry. Knowing they had been set up, the religious leaders refuse to answer. And Jesus responds likewise. And then Jesus goes on, "But what do you think?" And he tells this parable of the wicked tenants that we read earlier. Now we can see even more exactly why the chief priests and Pharisees became so angry that they wanted to arrest Jesus, only refraining themselves because of their fear of the crowd. There's no way the listeners would have missed that deliberate allusion to the text in Isaiah. I mean, listen to the way it starts. "There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, dug a wine press, built a watchtower." Sound familiar? It was they, the leaders, not the common people, who were the object of the parables given by Isaiah and Jesus. Isaiah and Jesus both challenged the notion that proper worship was more important than obedient living. Isaiah, like many other prophets in the Hebrew Scriptures, was quite aware that Israel's rebellion often did not take the form of shaking their fists in the face of God, refusing to obey his demands. More often, the Israelite people simply ignored some demands while appearing to follow the outward actions of religious practice. This indictment of the religious leaders was echoed by Jesus in his own day. In prophetic literature, planting a vineyard was often a sign of Yahweh's establishment of the covenant with the people of Israel. Digging a wine press and harvesting grapes was communal labor, and wandering nomadic people are unable to invest the time and care such a garden would require. However, the prophets proclaim that only those who produce the fruits of the kingdom will remain a people of God. God's blessing was not evidence of their goodness, but instead bore witness to the grace of God. Their status as an elected people was not a guarantee of their salvation. I don't think it's an accident that those who compiled the lectionary paired Psalm 80 with the alternate reading of Isaiah. Apparently, the function of the psalm in the lectionary, we're not a people of that have this as our tradition in the past, so I didn't know this. The function of the psalm is to serve as a spoken or sung response to the Old Testament text, and the imagery and content linked from Isaiah and the psalm is appropriate and intentional. One writer points out, however, that Psalm 80 may be less frequently focused on because it's one of the lament psalms. Lament psalms are mournful and angry. They invite us to list our own disillusionments and disappointments with God and with our lives. To be honest about our sometimes feelings of abandonment can be threatening. Perhaps also the communal corporate nature of the lament is foreign to those of us living in an individualistic society. We are all relatively comfortable and self-satisfied, and we're not familiar with identifying sin and guilt as a people. The psalm speaks out of a bleak setting. The kingdom has been divided, the nation lies in ruins and remembers with anger and sadness its former glory. The vineyard metaphor strongly echoes the language of Isaiah. The people are again compared to a planted vine which was nurtured and cared for by God, the divine gardener. The transplanted vine has taken deep root and flourished. But again, The walls have been broken down, allowing wild animals to trample the vineyard. The stock has been cut down and burnt. Meanwhile, the psalmist laments, God remains angry and distant. For space, some of the psalm is left out of the bulletin today. But there are three times the same refrain in this psalm. Restore us, O Lord God of hosts. Let your face shine that we may be saved. The paradox of a lament is that speaking the words of anger and longing for salvation is by itself an act of faith. Citing Walter Brueggemann, Tisdale reminds us that the dark psalms, like Psalm 80, are not as they first appear, that is, evidence of a lack of faith or an admission of failure. For the community which trusts in God, using such psalms and acts of worship, give expression of a transformed faith. This faith does not hold to the view, God is in his heaven, all's right with the world. But rather, it insists that the world be experienced as it really is. This faith insists that God is present in and participates in a world which includes darkness, weakness, and loss. It is not an accident that this psalm ends with the conclusion of restored hope and with a renewed vow to not turn back from God. Psalm 80 is the sung response to the hard words of judgment in Isaiah 5. Transformation and growth, righteousness and justice. Judgment and sin are real, but so is the final note of hope, mercy and grace. It is not enough to be planted as a vine if we do not produce fruit, if we do not live in the world as God's people, as transforming agents of God's grace. We ourselves need to be transformed, not only as individuals, but also as communities and as a church. The church, like Israel, cannot divorce right action and responsibility from being members of a covenant people. If we focus only on ourselves, the fruit will be bitter. If we allow ourselves to become vehicles of change in God's kingdom, all will see that we are bearing fruits of the Spirit. Isaiah says, righteousness without justice is not really righteousness. Or as one writer put it, our responsibility in the world as God's people is not just to be God's people, that is righteousness, but to allow being God's people to transform us into the people who care about others in the world. And that's justice. And as Menno Simons also wrote, this is true evangelical.